Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs to order. For the record, it's 3:35, 3:40 p.m. We're in the Thomas Stewart Building and in the Belts Room, and it is Tuesday, February 11th, 2020. Senator Hoffman, myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Gray Jackson is away on other state business and will not be joining us today. Senator Marchicki is working in another bill and will be here probably within 5 minutes. Senator Schauer is not with us at this time. He's on other state business as well. I'd like to recognize our staff, Christopher Dickrell, Taylor Kelly on the LIO, and Cody Gusendorf from my office. I'd like to remind everyone on the cell phones today. You're saying, well, okay, well, you don't have a quorum. And I said, well, this is an informational meeting. We got two of us, and we're going to start the process. So thank you. And today our agenda is the Sitna Watana project update. Curtis Thayer from AEA is here. And the second part of our today's meeting will be Mr. Bhutan from ADA, and we're going to get an Ambler Road update. So first, we're going to hear from AEA, Sue Sitna Watana, and Director Thayer. If you introduce yourself, you know the drill, sir, and put yourself on the record and let's roll. Senator Schauer is in attendance as well. Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Good afternoon. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And with me is Brian Carey, who is the Owned Assets Hydro Group Manager with AEA. Today's presentation is looking at Sitna-Watana. For some of those that were in the legislature 5-6 years ago, this is very similar to that same presentation. The project has been in abeyance since 2015, and no state money has been used to further the project since it's been in abeyance. So Sitna-Watana, clean, reliable energy for the next 100 years. Current status, 2014, the Administrative Order 271 puts the Sitna-Watana Hydro Project into abeyance, and in 2019, AO-306 rescinded AO-271, and no state funds were spent in fiscal year 2019. The energy policy. In 2010, House Bill 306 was passed and set an aspirational goal to generate 50% of the state's electricity from renewable and alternative energies by 2025. Why large hydro? In 2011, 21% of Alaska had hydropower, and in 2019, it has climbed to 27%, but it is clearly not at the 50-50 goal that was established in 2010. Why the Alaska Energy Authority? The legislature put into statute the powers of the authority, and that is to acquire a Sitna River project, whether it be by construction, purchase, gift, lease, including the acquisition of property rights and interest in eminent domain, and also to perform feasibility studies, engineering with design to respect two power projects. And the Alaska Energy Authority does serve as a state energy office. Why Sitna-Watana? And at this time, I'm going to turn over to Brian Carey, who worked on the project during the earlier phases.
Just before we kick off, we're at a full complement now. Senator Marchicki is here, and good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I had a meeting that ran late.
That's what I told him.
Okay. Just a little bit of history there. Back in 2010, AEA was tasked with taking a look, evaluating a couple of hydro projects, Susitna, Chalkachalma, and Glacier Fork. And Glacier Fork dropped out fairly quick because it'd be a relatively small project with no storage for the wintertime. So then it was mostly Susitna versus Chalkachalma. And from the standpoint of being able to meet 50% rail belt demand or actually being a significant contributor, Susitna was much greater than what Chalkachalma would be, had much greater storage, and so you could use it during the winter, less engineering challenges and less licensing challenges. And so that's pretty much why AEA went forward on the, in terms of the preliminary decision document, was Susitna would be the best project between the two of them. Certainly, once you build a hydro project, it should be operating for 100 plus years. Yeah, just a little bit of history. Most of the good hydro sites in Alaska were identified back in the 50s. And so actually, Susitna and a lot of other sites were identified during the 50s. During the 80s, there was significant studies done on Susitna. They drilled out there and they did various fish and wildlife type studies. And then during the mid-80s, they shut down the project. And we still have probably 3,000 old documents on microfiche left over from that. Those documents were used for, I'll say, the restart of Susitna back in 2010 to try and see what information there was and build upon that information. And so at this point, studies started on the Susitna in 2012 and continued for several years. And then we proceeded to, on the direction, I'll say, the governor licensing, put the licensing effort into abeyance. So this is just kind of a map of the area for people to get an idea of where it's located at. It's approximately 125 miles northeast of Anchorage, and I believe around 125 also south of Fairbanks. So it's about mid-distance between the two. 187 river miles up from Cook Inlet and above Devil's Canyon and Talkeetna. So the basin it's getting is about 5,000 square miles that it's draining at that location. So at a glance, approximate height, 705 feet. That's under the assumption that bedrock is about 100 feet below what the river bottom would be, because you actually measure the dam height from bedrock generally, and so that there's a little bit of unknown on that. It could end up being 705 or 650. Dam elevation would be correct. Reservoir length, 42 miles. The big part on here is the capacity and the energy. The capacity of 459 is at the average water level, because that you have a drawdown of 200 feet, and the average drawdown is, if you go at 100 feet, you actually produce less energy per unit of water. So the 619 megawatts you see is when you're producing energy at a full pool. And so when you see different numbers, it only it's the same generators. It's just a case of how full the reservoir is with water. Annual energy, 2.8 million megawatt hours, is, from the last I saw, is about 60% of what the rail belt is. So the cost in 2014 numbers came out as approximately $5.6 billion, and that was the 50th percentile. So engineering first on it, size and generation, that was, you had to look upon what the topography was and how much water to come up with the generation size and how high you're going to build it. The higher you build the dam, the thicker the dam has to be, and so there's added cost the higher up you go. But on the other hand, is the lower you go, the less energy you get out of there and the less storage you get out of it. All the time during the FERC processing process, you had the board of consultants, which FERC will require, and these are people that generally have 40 or 50 plus years in their specialty. And so at different critical points of the design, they would review those design, we'll review some of the design and what questions came up to make sure that we were on track. In general, when we did the studies, the probable maximum flood, it's actually less than 10,000 year flood, but it was designed at a 10,000 year flood. And that should be able to pass the what would be called the probable maximum flood with one of the spillway gates inoperable. The maximum credible earthquake, it's in the middle of a large plate, and so any of the what you normally think is the big faults are north of the site in the Alaska Range or south of the site, and the site location is in the middle of a intraplate, and that's so it was designed, those were considered to be what would be the largest seismic source within the plate where it's at. And actually at this point I'm going to just, this slide picture was off of an animation that came off of what the engineering drawings were, and I'm going to play a short video that just better shows the different project. As you zoom around, it was all taken off of the engineering drawings. So
up to the top corner, I think. go to escape. That's right. There we go.
So this is approaching it from the downstream on the south bank where the access road is. Off on the left side, you've got the spillway chutes for if you've got too much overflow condition. And on the upstream side, you've got where the quarry site is to get rock for the dam. And that was done because you'll get covered up by water and it actually increases your storage and will not show after the dam is built. Your substation is right in the foreground on the right side.
What are you looking at? Tell them.
So just go in the interior and show where the turbine locations would be. And these powerhouses are extremely quiet when you're in there. You'll go in there and it'll be quieter than a normal street. The machinery, which is where the turbines are, actually takes up several levels. And the amount of concrete to hold everything with how heavy they are is a large quantity of concrete.
It's my understanding that Hoover Dam is still cooling the concrete in Hoover Dam.
Probably it is.
A lot of concrete.
And there's various galleries that go through the middle of this that you can use for drains and get access to different areas. The white line across the front is more of a boom to prevent debris or boats from getting too close to the dam crest. And as part of the project, we'd had to build a construction camp at the start, and then once it was constructed, then we would be converting over many of the house, have houses for the permanent people that stay there. And the airstrip that would be used for people to commute in and out.
Is there more?
That's
it. Thank you.
Okay. Economics, back in 2015, Northern Economics went off and did a economic analysis in terms of Susitna, and based on the projection of the natural gas prices at the time and what the energy savings would be because of the reduction in thermal natural gas or coal or oil that was being used along the rail belt, then that's how they came up with the benefit cost ratio from the energy savings. And so all the other numbers are from what the savings would be from the fuel cost savings.
next.
So the same report for the Northern Economics, this is what they came up on terms of the employment effects-wise for the construction and for what there would be work afterwards, the indirect construction. Oh, okay. So during the middle of the construction, there would be a peak workforce of actually, I think, around, several thousand during the construction. They say 12,000. I generally don't think of it as 12,000, that it would be less than that, but there would be actually a lot of additional indirect type construction workforce of thousands of people. The spending that would be from construction spending, this is coming up. Northern Economics came up with 11,000, and I'm not sure what the multiplier is on that one for the indirects, but it'd be a very substantial employment during construction. After construction, I don't think we have what those numbers are. Okay, licensing status. We've been using the integrated licensing process to this point, or when it went into abeyance. There's various steps that has to occur during the process, and of those steps, we're about two-thirds of the way done with them. There was originally 58 FERC-approved studies, and 19 studies are completed. There actually could be a couple of extra studies past that, and not all those studies are field studies. Some of those studies are desktop studies, such as the potential maximum flood or seismic type studies, and so there's actually a bunch of those studies which are desktop ones. The studies that are not completed yet, we've gotten first year study results, and then at that time we went back to the different agencies to get their comments and potentially modifications to change how they go. And so those studies then have not been completed, say, a second year, but they've been substantially along the way. At this point, there's so we do have more than 19 of the studies done with study completion reports. And once we finish up studies, or if there was to be studies finished up, there would be impact assessment done. There would be a draft license. And then there would be protection, mitigation, and enhancement type measures that would be proposed. And then there would be a final license. And so that would still take several years of effort.
So on this licensing status, so the data we have is not stale and would still be relevant towards the FERC license?
All the data is good at some point, and FERC can always ask for more data, or they could ask for less, and I don't know what they would be doing.
So if I'm reading this right, we're two-thirds of the way done on the licensing status?
That two-thirds is on the initial licensing status, licensing FERC. Process, FERC licensing process that we moved along.
Okay.
Okay, so on the study plan determination, once the first year study was done for many of the studies, I mentioned about touching back with the agencies and FERC, and FERC would look out to see if they were adequate or not, or the agencies, and then several of the agencies put in some requests to modify some of the studies, and for the most part, FERC accepted most of the studies to that point. They rejected most of the study modification requests. They did take some modification requests to change the studies for additional study on it, and so at this point, that's where that stands. It was put into abeyance soon afterwards. So this is kind of a project timeline. For the standpoint of the pre-application phase, we're up there into that light blue on the top before we put in the FERC application. Once you put in the FERC application, then we would be able to, depending on what things are done, you could either go towards final design and site investigation at that point, or you could wait until you get the license or not. There's different things you could do as being in parallel or following one after the other. But the big part is once you get to the construction phase, then, yeah, probably about 9-10 years is more what you're going to be receiving power. You might be able to receive power from the project in 8 years, but and this one right now shows 9 to 11 years, but the engineering report put it down as being once you start construction that you should be able to start receiving power at 8 years.
Okay, so at this point, really it's the governor and the legislature determines next steps. That is, you know, if it is green lighted, obviously determining the licensing status would be the next step, and then updating the cost estimate to obtain the license, update benefit, cost, and economic analysis, and then review the data to assure it remains reflective of the current conditions. And obviously there will always be ongoing consulting with FERC, landowners, and all the stakeholders if this project is to be advanced.
Do you have any numbers off the top of your head, the last time we were in 2014 numbers, what the kilowatt hour might be?
Earlier slide, it showed 2.8 million megawatt hours, so kilowatt hours, add three more zeros to that. And, you know, I don't know, 2.8 billion kilowatt hours or so.
Price per kilowatt.
Oh, price per kilowatt. I'll have to get back to you that.
Thank you.
It's about six to six and a half cents, based on the 2014 numbers.
2014 numbers, 6.5 cents.
Correct.
Kilowatt.
And Bradley Lake, which is the state's largest hydro project, is about 4 to 4.5 cents, and the cost of natural gas is about 8 to 8.5 cents on an average for the cost of the gas. So it fits between what we're paying for natural gas and versus what hydro on the rail belt is currently.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Senator Schauer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that taking into account transmission? So the transmission lines for the kilowatt hours and the aggregate package, or is that just what it's going to cost to produce based on the actual cost of the project?
Through the chair, that is actually the cost to produce the power. That does not include the transmission. It's an average on the railroad of roughly 20 cents, give or take. Some are 23, some are a little bit less, but average of 20. But that's the cost of
energy. I just want to know what was included in making that calculation.
Good question. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Michicki.
Thank you. It's hard to tell how the basin affects upstream. Are there private landowners in the area that would be flooded to create a basin? Reservoir?
Through the chair, probably 95% of that land is Native Corporation land, and there may be some U.S. government land in there, but I'm not aware of small private inholdings.
Through the chair, we'll get you that number, because a lot of the land that would be flooded is actually BLM land, and so we can get you that breakdown of land ownership for the proposed project.
Right. Mr. Thank you. Please continue.
Yeah, I noticed the first studies were federal, which is what kind of got me interested in the land ownership. And I have forgotten a lot of our earlier reviews of this project. So essentially what you're saying right now is that you're two-thirds of the way through the pre-application phase. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
And the project's essentially on hold unless the governor and legislature gives you a green light to move forward. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. We appreciate it, and stay tuned. We'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you very much.
Take a brief at ease while we change out presenters, and we'll have our next group up, Mr. Boutin from ADA. He's going to give us an update on the Ambler Road project. Please introduce yourself.
You bet. Tom Boutin, ADA. I've been on the job 1 year today, by gosh. And
congratulations.
Glad to be back in Juneau, and No complaints. Curtis and I share a building, and of course, we share most of the staff, he's always pleading poverty. And I was impressed with those graphics he had, didn't you?
That might have been 2011 money.
Okay. It was impressive anyway. And Ambler is a 200-mile, 50-foot, 50-year right-of-way. And it's one of the large projects included in what we just heard from Curtis, that the previous administration put in coal storage. And as soon as Governor Dunleavy came in, he cranked Ambler back up. This would bring economic development to a region that doesn't have a lot of economic development right now. I'll try to go through this kind of quickly. When I was first on the ADA board, we financed the DeLong Mountain Transportation Project, the Red Dog Road and Port, and ADA still retains ownership of that. And this Ambler project lends itself to the same public finance model with the debt service paid by toll road tolls to the mine road. With the DeLong Mountain Transportation project, it supports the local borough. Last time I looked, the Northwest Arctic Borough still had on their website the FY18 receipts, and they received $22 million from Red Dog in 2018. And Ambler has the potential to be very soon four Red Dogs, and further out, as many as 12 or 13 Red Dogs. It's remarkable for its size. With Red Dog, ADA continued to provide support, so we refinanced it at least once along the way. Red Dog was a relatively new type of financing, using public finance for natural resource development back when it was done. It still isn't a common public finance use to develop natural resources, but it's a pretty good one for Alaska. I don't know where interest rates will be when this ADA is ready to do the first Ambler bonds, but certainly right now we have easier capital than in any time in my adult life, and one can only hope that would persist. So this project starts at mile 161 of the Dalton Highway and heads west for 211 miles. It crosses state, federal, and private land. Notably, it will cross a national park, but as you probably know, that was provided for in Anilka. It doesn't mean that there might not be a fight someplace along the way, but we do think we have our ducks lined up in any respect. The mining district itself is just about the same.
Tom, can we talk? Is their alternate route that's here on the previous page? So where are we at with the discussion and the stakeholder engagement with the tribes and the permitting? Are we still looking? I mean, is this optional route still in play, or have we got a solid route? Can you help me there?
Yeah, let me sort of.
If it's further in the slide, then.
No, let me kind of go offline and address that, because you never know about time and whatnot. First of all, the EIS is now due March 5th, and the record of decision will be 30 days later. The record of decision will include the Corps of Engineers 404 water permit. As far as stakeholder participation. There were 21. ADA hired the BLM to do the EIS, and paying for the consultants and everybody's time and expenses. There were 21 hearings. There was a range of from two participants in one hearing up to a max up to 96 participants at the Fairbanks hearing, an average of 29 participants at each hearing. I only attended the one in Anchorage. I would go out on a limb and characterize the public participation as about the same as you might expect for a large state timber sale. Not rancor, not pickets outside the building, as I've seen with State of Alaska timber sales, for instance. But definitely concerns expressed that have been addressed, will be addressed, will continue to be addressed. There might be a, if I had to characterize it, I would say that from what I've listened to and observed, there are demographics revealed with the public comments. People in, I'll say, our age group certainly express concern about subsistence values and changes to lifestyle. People in their 20s and 30s are very focused on jobs and the costs of living out in rural areas. And many people talked about Red Dog and how Red Dog has brought jobs to a region, and they would like to see jobs, similar jobs available in this particular part of the state. So that's my nutshell summary of the public comment. As you know, Mr. Chairman, I've been through an awful lot of public processes, particularly on timber. This was not especially different than public comments on new timber development or larger timber sales. Of course, in a prospective project like this, you don't have existing sawmills there with their people saying we need the wood. Instead, this is off into the future, so you don't have the miners or for that matter, the mining companies there presenting their viewpoint. So the public process was very heavily weighted to members of the public and their concerns, which included the need for economic development, as it also included concerns about values and resources.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Get that a little closer. It may be coming up here. I haven't really looked at this one at all yet, but our typically, like at Red Dog and other places, a lot of the folks that go in and out fly, just based on distances. So is there any thought or plan to the kind of traffic that's going to generate and in this project, either upgrading or the impacts that will have for that type of travel? To, because I assume if you open these mines and you're going to have a lot of people traveling in and out. So what is that assumed or somewhere addressed in this?
If I understand you through the chair, if I understand your question, there is a provision for a small number of airports. I don't remember the number, but so I shouldn't say it, but it's on the order of two or three. But definitely road access will be the primary way that it'd be the only way that the material gets out. And it'll be the primary way that supplies and equipment and whatnot go in. I don't know if that answered your
it
question.
Doesn't, I don't think we need to answer, Mr. Chairman. I just want it more for the record that I think on this one, you know, you're going to have a lot of people with that kind of distance wintertime are going to fly. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the smaller airports are not necessarily prepared to handle that based on that kind of traffic if mining jumped to the level that you were talking. So somewhere in the planning and development, I hope we are discussing the impacts and upgrades and other things that may have to happen to be able to handle that kind of traffic load, because that could be pretty significant.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
I guess a better, maybe a way to ask that is which agencies are evaluating and participating in the EIS process?
We've had participation by the state agencies and by a number of federal agencies, including the Park Service, the Corps of Engineers, of course, the BLM. ADA has funded work by Department of Natural Resources. We've also had, and I have had, conversations and communications with Fish and Game. So state and federal agencies have been involved, and of course this originally was a DOT project, and the original funding was an appropriation to Alaska DOT, and the project was turned over to ADA just a few years ago. Just
follow up, Mr. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking, I mean, you talked about a 404, and you're essentially in a NEPA EIS process, so you can share the details of the exhaustive aspects that are considered during the NEPA process with anyone that's interested that might be sitting at this table, which include considerations about the impacts and infrastructure needs along the path, as well as construction and post-construction impacts. Is that right?
Our EIS is for a 50-foot right-of-way for this 211-mile road, and the 404, the water quality will be part of the record of decision. Each of the mines will have to be permitted, and this EIS does not treat the mining impacts.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Boutin, if you would provide our committee, have your staff give us a chart of all the affected agencies that are touched to build this road.
State and federal agencies?
State and federal, because yep. Just for conversation here, to build a road right now between the state of Alaska, DOT, they have to permit with almost 60 state and federal agencies before the first shovel full of dirt is turned, and on a good day that takes over 6 years. So if you could provide us with a chart, because you're crossing some park lands and some state land, some federal land, and shareholder land, just you know, have your people, they've got that at their fingertips.
Sure, I'd be glad to give you such a list.
Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman, same thing. I would ask for that on maybe a DOT assessment for us, because the reason I keyed on the air travel one is only because I understand you build the road, things are there right away, that's all taken care of if it's ever built. But we're going to be on the hook for maintaining the airport and people coming in and out. And I'll tell you right now, like I said, if you look at some of the other more remote sites, people will typically fly in. So I don't see that in here anywhere. And that's something we're going to be responsible for, and I can almost guarantee you, and I'm only saying it because that was kind of my lane, that they're not prepared for that, and we just need to have that included. So I'd love to see how that may be tied in, or the question asked, is it?
Through the chair, certainly. However, this will be a private road, and the airports will be private. But, yes, I'd be glad to get you that information. Well, again, as I think I was saying, the actual mineral district is about the same size as the state of Delaware. The solid line there shows the area that Trilogy and Nana have agreed to develop, and then the shaded area is some Nana property the gray area in the bottom left there is some NANA land where NANA has options for royalties and ownership. The four stars are the most advanced projects of the 12 or 13 that have been identified. To put this in perspective, of course, right now Alaska has five operating mines, two of them here in Juneau. So those initial mines will do something in the way of a 100% increase in mining in Alaska. This shows the resource potential and the value of those four first projects that we expect, shows the values and the kind of metals that are there and identified, and they happen to be, in many cases, the minerals that are in demand right now. Not only copper, but cobalt, zinc, lead, gold, and silver. Trilogy and South 32 have been making announcements starting in December. South 32 is a major mining investor investing company with $10 billion in net assets. This is starting out a magnitude, many magnitudes stronger than Red Dog. When Ada did that Red Dog financing, it was in some respects a rescue of a project that was ready to go and was in badly in need of financing. And there's just a lot more capital around today, but also this is a much more mineralized area than had been identified for Red Dog.
Senator Michicki has a question, Tom.
Thanks.
Yeah, Tom, I'm just curious. I Red Dog delivers their product through Norton Sound. Is that correct?
It's lightered out, and then it's taken to Dawa, as well as I think a smelter in BC gets some of it. This is just anecdotal, what I know.
And it was at some point someone made the determination that there was no feasible way to move the product west for a shorter distance for a marine terminal there versus moving east to the Dalton?
For Red Dog?
For the Ambler Mining District.
Yeah, at the moment, the plan certainly is to ship the product to Fairbanks and be put on a rail in Fairbanks. And currently it's to be taken to the Anchorage, what is most often called Port of Alaska now. So that's the current plan. It's a few years down the road, and you know, who knows how the economics might finally come out, but that's the plan.
Thank you.
This slide shows the expected jobs of those first four mines, and something, and you know, some indication of the income that we might see, and it's roughly comparable to four Red Dogs, really. To give you an idea, and I've got a graph, a table here that I don't think is a slide, maybe in this presentation, though I've had it in as a slide in other presentations. I think I said that Red Dog paid $22 million to the Northwest Arctic Borough in 2018. Well, a comparable payment in lieu of taxes for these four mines would create an estimated $118 million a year. So, you know, 22 to red, from Red Dog to the Northwest Arctic Burrow right now, and these first four mines, an estimated 118 in a comparable payment of, in lieu of taxes. I should point out that $22 million is I think it's predominantly a payment in lieu of taxes, but then the Northwest Arctic Burrow also has an income tax kind of thing they call a MOC. And so it's the 22 is those two amounts combined. This private road will have radio equipped trucks, control speeds, protocols just like Red Dog and Caribou are on the highway. Everything comes to a halt at Red Dog. All personnel will follow those protocols. DeLong Mountain Transportation, Red Dog, has a subsistence advisory committee, and this road also will have a subsistence advisory committee. And from all reports, it works well at Red Dog, and I would think everything would work similarly well for this road. Again, as a private road, just as Red Dog is a private road.
Senator Hoffman?
What's the length of the Red Dog DeLong Road and the length of this road?
I've been to Red Dog and been on that road, and I want to say
57 miles.
Pardon?
57 miles.
Yep. And our board chair in the back of the room built that road. So if you've got anything more technical than that to ask about the Red Dog Road, we could drag that the ADA board chair right up here, and because he built the road.
Yeah, he left, but he didn't
build. Oh, did he?
He didn't build it by himself because I was helping him.
I see. Okay. Okay. I guess this is the Red Dog Road, of course. And certainly Caribou have been one of the concerns expressed by people at the public meetings and written input. The Red Dog Mine is compatible with Caribou, the Red Dog Transportation, and I don't know any reason to believe that Ambler would be any different. The draft EIS states that our Ambler Access Project would only affect 0.005% of the Western Arctic Caribou Herd's natural range. So, this just is a graphic that treats the public. We have two regional corporations involved, and certainly we cross a lot of native corporation land in addition to state and federal land. Six different landowners, actually.
There's some, these others two to be determined, there's some private inholders in there, right? Is that what they would fall under?
Well, there are some private inholders. I'm not aware of needing to cross their land, but we certainly do have to cross major amounts of native corporation land, and we certainly have been talking with those landowners right from the beginning.
Thank you.
The enabling statutes for ADA just talk exclusively about jobs and economic development, nothing about return on investment, no prudent investor rule, no return on capital. Revenue bonds certainly are available for this project, and if we were ready to go to market with those bonds, they'd be avidly sought right now, and I hope the capital markets are similar when we get there. I want to say that, you know, this public financing won't use state money. It'll be supported entirely by toll revenues in some shape or form of take or pay bonds, and so the mineral development will be on the hook. That isn't to say that we wouldn't take a look at using ADA's general obligation, as ADA has often used in financing, if that kind of credit backstop would be cost effective. It's a ways down the road before those kinds of decisions have to be looked at, and they'll be looked at in the context of whatever the capital markets are at that time. It's a pretty involved graphic, but it's I think a pretty pretty important one. Stages 1 and 2 used appropriated funds appropriated to DOT and then later to ADA by the Alaska legislature. Then in October of last year, the ADA board approved spending $718,000 out of ADA's capital to fund the project through the record of decision. Once we have a record of decision under NEPA for the EIS, we'll proceed to use our own resources to work with private investors for the front-end development design and for the right-of-way acquisition across those parcels of private land. The ADA board has talked quite extensively with mining companies and said that for stages 4 through 6, at least 50% of that cost will be paid for by the mining companies. If that all falls into place, we could be funding field work and surveying and LIDAR as early as this summer. We'll see, of course, but we're really to the end of the EIS process. The stage 7 assumes a certain design success, and it's just a best guess at this point. We really haven't done a lot of work on the ground. You know, when I came up here, I designed and built roads on the Tongass National Forest for Ketchikan Pulp under the 50-year contract. Ketchikan Pulp did everything, and once in a while, a Forest Service would come out and look it over. And, of course, on the Tongass, it's all shot rock, which is a very expensive way. And, you know, when I did come up here, up in the Ambler country, I think you, setting aside bridges, because they're a whole different thing for apples and apples, you could have built road up in that country for about 5 new pickup trucks a mile without worrying about the bridges. And this calculates, and of course pickup trucks have moved with inflation. This road, the way I do the calculation anyway, and I bought a new pickup last summer, is about 40 pickups a mile. Which is amazing to me, that costs have gone up like that, and Alaska has to face that. Boeing and Subaru are probably not going to build plants soon in the rail belt, and so our natural resources are what we have, and costs of extracting those natural resources have gone up at far, far higher rates of increase than the rate of inflation, and that we compete throughout the world, and this is where our jobs are going to come from, realistically. You know, Amazon didn't decide to move to Anchorage, and so this is what we're looking for year-round family wage kind of jobs, is resource extraction like this, and the costs are high. But on the other hand, I was just reading a number. I can't remember the number, but a handful of Texas oil executives have been held in Venezuela in house arrest for several years, and just this week they were moved to prison. They've never been indicted. They've never been really accused of anything, let alone tried. So even though our costs might be high, Alaska is a very stable, reliable environment, and when people take a risk on a resource in Alaska, they know the bandwidth of that risk.
Operation and maintenance of the road, my final question. That's will be with Trilogy or the other partners in the projects?
Absolutely, yes. As it is with Red Dog.
Plus, we have better prisons.
Well, I'll take your word for that through the chair. I'll take your word for that.
Committee members? Chair Machicki?
Yeah, I don't need it right here, but I'd like to know more about the commercial details of your tariff structure. What I don't want to get back into, and I'm supportive of mining and supportive in concept of this project, I just like to know where the true risk lies. We passed a bill called the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. State spent more money on credits than they did the value of all the hydrocarbons that were created by that act, and we took on the burden. We still owe for it. So I just want to, and I don't mean to compare this with the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and those credits, but I would like to understand the structure in detail to see if I can support it commercially. Like to know that our risk balances with reward for the state and the people of Alaska, and I'm willing to plug in some numbers for the jobs and for the economic activity, obviously. I think you know me, Tom, well enough. Tom happens to be a shooting partner of mine, although he's a lot better than I am. But I would like to see more detail on that, before I can say whether or not I'd be in favor of the project moving forward. So anything you can do to provide, perhaps through the chair, we may hear this more in resources. You've got good arguments on both sides of both of the projects we're discussing today, and I think what moves that kind of project forward is getting them out on the table and talking about them. So whatever you can provide me on the commercial structure would be very helpful moving forward.
Yep, through the chair, I'll certainly provide you information. And particularly, I think it's useful to look at Red Dog from inception to today and you know, what the risk was and what the return has been, both to the borough and to the state. And I think that would be useful because except that this is much larger, it's very, very much like Red Dog.
Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question and a comment. The question is, there's some areas around there where you have folks living in rural Alaska, that or some of those towns are close by, and I can't tell on the map. Is there plans for a road reach out where they're going to be able to have access to these? Is there a plan to get them the ability to get there quickly? It talks about roads, but it wasn't specific.
Through the chair, I do have a table that shows the distance, from to the road by all the various villages. What we do at Red Dog, there are one or more villages where there's a provision to leave off gasoline and other resources. I think it's lowered the price of gasoline for that village by 2/3. So there'll be that kind of usage available, as well as, of course, access by public safety, emergency vehicles, and whatnot. The degree to which a community might want to actually have road access to this road, that would be yet to be determined. It does have to be a private road, but at the same time, the stakeholders in the area have every right to have an improvement of not just jobs, but an improvement of their lifestyle if that's what they want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought it's kind of important with your workforce, other things when they're out there, plus right-of-way access. I'm sure that'll be worked out later. The other is just a comment, circle back from a briefing a couple days ago. If we don't grow it, we mine it. And I think we're often afraid to build anything anymore, at least it seems that way. And we had a briefing here where we discussed around the planet who might have many of the resources locked up. For example, a country that's not particularly friendly to us, China, has 96% of the rare earth metals. And so I think, Mr. Chairman, as we look at this going forward, when you think about the value of those and the lawless nature of, and the tension around the planet in many places, that the ability to move forward on projects that would allow us to mine critical resources that we need for just modern-day living around us, I think there's long-term value in that. We shouldn't be afraid of it. There's risk. We need to do it right, responsibly, make sure we're mitigating those risks, but not just the economic impacts, but just national security and other things. I think this is important to not forget that we need those resources for the modern-day living that we have, and those other sources can be very unstable. So I just want that, again, Mr. Chairman, thank you, put that on the record, that these are the kind of things Alaska contributes, not just to the state, but the country, and we shouldn't forget that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Governor Dunleavy, no one believes that more than he does, and he checks in on where these projects are, and he either remembers it or writes it down. I don't know. It's by phone when he contacts us, and so he's following mineral developments from Ketchikan to Ambler, Haynes, of course, the Palmer project, the Constantine there, in Haynes. The governor is following these very closely, and I know he believes that's where the jobs are going to come from, and that's where our gross state product that we need to increase, that's where that's going to come from. And no governor has been, in my experience, has been as attuned to natural resource development as this one.
Thank you. This concludes today's meeting. It's 4:42, and we are done for the day. And no meeting on Thursday, gentlemen.
Sure.
Doggone it anyway. We're adjourned.